Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Now, many thought it was reckless for President Macron in France to call a snap election, and today we should get a good indication of whether those critics were right and whether the President did indeed miscalculate. It's the first of the two rounds of voting today, and the key question: despite Macron's hopes, will France shift away from the pragmatic centre and towards leftist and rightist coalitions with quite ideological elements? On the right, it's the National Rally. On the left, the Popular Front. The President's centrist alliance is Together, Ensemble. Well, these voters from near Bordeaux in southwestern France gave their views on the elections.
C'est un grand enjeu pour la France.
There is a lot at stake for France, for our future.
Il faut que les choses changent.
Things must change. They need to change.
De toute façon, on peut pas être plus déçu que ce...
We can't be more disappointed than we already are anyway.
A lot at stake, one said there, and this man in Paris also said a lot was riding on the vote.
I hope that every French person will face up to their responsibilities, that they will realise that there is a lot at stake, and that for once they will realise that the future of their country is in their hands, in the hands of 40 million French voters. And I'm very happy to see that the turnout is going to increase significantly, because our democratic institutions are at stake.
Well, the BBC's Rob Young is in Hénin-Beaumont. It's the heartland of Marine Le Pen country. And so why don't you just tell us about that, first of all? What's it look like? Where is it? Why is it Le Pen country?
Yeah, we're in northeast France. It's a very pretty town, Hénin-Beaumont. Lots of brightly coloured, manicured flower beds, some beautiful, very attractive buildings in the centre of the town. It's a pretty quiet place, to be honest. And that, you know, you may well be able to hear the birdsong and behind me the odd car engine as people head to the supermarket over the road from the polling station I'm standing outside of, which during the week is a music school. But the quiet, the peaceful nature of Hénin-Beaumont is generally shattered on polling day in recent years, as it was today, because Marine Le Pen, the leader of the National Rally, is the MP for this area. She votes at this music school here. And when she emerged after having cast a vote for herself earlier on, I managed to grab a quick word with her. And as she emerged from the polling station, she was greeted by her supporters like a rock star.
Je suis un naturel optimiste.
Madame Le Pen, BBC d'Angleterre, êtes-vous confiante pour la victoire?
Je ne peux pas faire de commentaires. Je n'ai pas le droit de. Je n'ai pas le droit de faire de commentaires.
She's telling me there that she can't really tell me anything at all until the polls have closed at 8 p.m. and that's when we'll get an official projection. But there were dozens of supporters here taking selfies with her, asking for her autograph as she emerged. They applauded wildly and they followed her down the road, as did a lot of French and, yes, us, the international media too.
Yeah, that was quite interesting. You were able to get to her quite easily, were you? Is she surrounded by security?
She did have some security staff with her. There were a few police officers around as well. But I was also surprised, having covered British and other elections, at how close and how easily I was able to get to. I was walking alongside her for a couple of minutes with a microphone under her nose.
Yeah, despite the fact that France has had its fair share, more than its fair share, of major security incidents. Tell us about the high turnout expected. Why is that? And, you know, how high?
So at midday, the official figure that we have is turnout was at about 26%, whereas in the last parliamentary elections nationally, it was at about 18%. So turnout is already up on the last time people voted for the National Assembly. And when you speak to people, not just here, but elsewhere in other parts of France, because I've spent a couple of days in the city of Lille as well, people do see this election as consequential. The supporters of Marine Le Pen's National Rally are excited. They hope that her party could win a majority in the National Assembly and form a government. And the opponents, not just in the centre, but also in this coalition of left-wing and extreme-left parties that was cobbled together pretty quickly just 3 weeks ago, they also see this as a very important election because they see their chances of blocking the National Rally from forming a government as reasonably high, because the country, according to the opinion polls, is split pretty much three ways, with the National Rally in the lead, followed by the left-wing bloc. But we'll find out after 8 o'clock tonight, French time, how those blocs have done.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. So thank you for that. 8 o'clock, what, there's an exit poll, is there?
Yeah, there'll be projections out after 8 o'clock, but because this is the first of two rounds, you can't directly translate today's results into a number of seats in the National Assembly, because there may be tactical voting taking place a week today.
No, absolutely. We're going to just discuss that now. So thank you very much, Rob Young. And as I say, let's get a broader take on the sort of manoeuvring that may be happening over the next couple of weeks. Isabelle Guinadot is a researcher at the Centre for European Studies at Sciences Po. Well, first of all, just in general terms, today's voting, what is she expecting?
The opinion polls are pretty consistent. So I think that we have a fairly good idea of the result to expect. And it will be, on the one hand, a very high level of participation compared to the last legislative elections. That could be about 20% higher. And on the other hand, probably the results will confirm that France is divided into three blocks, with one block ahead, clearly ahead, that is the far-right block, that is credited with 36% of the vote, followed by the left-wing block with 29% of the vote. And then behind we find the block supporting Emmanuel Macron, Ensemble, with about 20% of the vote. And then we have far behind the mainstream right with 8%.
Well, that's fascinating, because that suggests, if you top those numbers up, that the right as a whole have got something like 42%, and the left and the centre have got 49%. Now, in the past, the left and the centre would gang up and in the second round make sure there's one candidate opposing the right-wing candidate, so that the right-wing would be frustrated. Is that likely to happen this time?
Exactly. So in the past, we call them the Republican parties, those that are not far right, used to join forces, and that used to apply as well to the mainstream right. This is the biggest question, because due to the electoral system, it is very difficult to anticipate a seat distribution from the voting intentions polled by the institutes. And you can note that all institutes publish voting intentions, but none has so far dared to publish a projection in terms of seats. So as you note, the result will importantly depend on two things. The first is how many candidates will maintain themselves in many districts. So how many will be in the second round? If we had many configurations with three candidates in the second round, this would benefit strongly the national rally. If we have only two candidates, or if we have the third candidate withdrawing to prevent the national rally to win, that could be far more uncertain.
Yeah. So it's an absolutely fascinating situation, because the next 2 weeks, I mean, we have to say that these are only opinion polls and who knows and all the rest of it. But if it works out like you're saying, the next 2 weeks we'll see a lot of politicking. It's a question of whether the anti-national rally vote is prepared to cooperate with each other to frustrate the national rally.
Exactly. And you say the next 2 weeks, but I think what will be important will be the reactions to the results tonight.
Okay.
So far, we see a lot of people in the left bloc who call to join forces to prevent a very serious possibility that the national rally has an absolute majority in parliament. But not everyone is ready to call to vote for Macron. So especially in the left factions of the France Insoumise, some people say no vote for the national rally, but they do not explicitly call to vote for Macron or even for a mainstream right politician. If we look at the discourses of Emmanuel Macron himself and his ministers, we do not see so far any sign that they will withdraw candidates and call for supporting the left. Actually, they have campaigned a lot against the left and presented the left front as an equally radical alternative as the national rally.
Okay, so, I mean, you know, you're there watching it all. What do you expect? Do you think candidates will withdraw and make this into a two-horse race in a lot of these seats or not?
It is very difficult to say. So far, we don't see any sign that either Macron or the conservative bloc will call to support the left against the far right. Mm-hmm. We could even see signs of the contrary. But I don't know what could be the effect of a shock tonight if we have a lot of far-right politicians elected already in the first round, and if we have the confirmation that the far-right is on the verge of entering government. That shock could perhaps trigger Emmanuel Macron and his allies to withdraw candidates and to call to vote for the left. That would make a decisive difference for the final result in terms of seat distribution in parliament.
It'll make a huge difference, absolutely. If the Marine Le Pen national rally is blocked once again by everyone else basically ganging up on her to keep her out, do you think her supporters, you know, who are now growing in number around 36%, you're saying, you know, it's a significant proportion of the French electorate, do you think they will be angry? And what might happen if they feel once again, you know, as the largest party, they've been denied?
Yes, it depends on the final results. It could be that an alliance, we say a Republican front, would prevent an absolute majority of the national rally, but they could still be the biggest fraction in parliament. And then the question is rather what Macron will do. Will the other bloc manage to negotiate coalition that would prevent them from being in power? But even there is still the possibility that Macron still has to appoint someone from the national rally if they arrive first, and then we would have minority governments. It is true that the voters of the national rally, there used to be a lot of protest vote, but this time the polls show that they really want the national rally to be in office, and there are a lot of hope with that. I am concerned about the reactions of the voters, perhaps especially after the second round, that there could be riots in the streets.
What's your assessment of Macron's decision? Clever or just foolish?
I think that most observers would agree to see that was highly risky. And that must be a strategic decision. I don't know if his strategy was to hope to gain on the division of the left bloc to regain a majority thanks to the Republican front, which didn't work out because the left managed to build an alliance. Or if Macron perhaps count on the fact of having a cohabitation with the far right. He has been in power since 7 years, concentrating all responsibilities. He's much detested in the country, and perhaps he hopes on a cohabitation with the far right to regain base. But in my view, that is a very risky option.
And that was Isabelle Guillado and all the permutations. So things to look for, basically the exit poll later today, towards the end of the day. And then how many outright victories, how many two-way contests in a couple of weeks' time, how many three-way contests in a couple of weeks' time, and how many of those three-way contests will see someone drop out to make them into two-way contests. Very interesting French politics. You're listening to NewsHour on the World Service of the BBC. And coming up, earlier this week, President Biden pardoned thousands of US veterans convicted under a military law that banned gay sex. We'll hear from two women who were arrested for being in a same-sex relationship while serving in the 1980s.
Our security clearances were removed. We weren't allowed to sign out firearms any longer. Apparently, we couldn't be trusted. And we were relegated to answering phones, washing cars, and painting things.
But I was reduced to cleaning latrines, and it was the male latrines.
That's coming up in around 30 minutes' time. Other headlines, the French were saying, are voting in parliamentary elections with the far right poised to make significant gains. Turnout's been high. I should have said the next round is in a week's time. And populist parties in Hungary, Austria and the Czech Republic say they're forming an alliance in the European Parliament and are inviting like-minded parties to join. The Afghan Taliban government is attending UN talks in Qatar today. Now, the UN says this isn't recognition, it's just that there are things to talk about, such as the economy and drugs. Well, the BBC's Carrie Davis is in Qatar for these talks. And just on this recognition issue, first of all, can you sort of bring us up to date on where the world's got to on that? Who actually recognises the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan?
So, Owen, at the moment, no country recognises that Afghanistan is ruled by the Taliban. That is not official recognition. That has not happened yet. However, there is a little bit of grey area with certain countries. So Beijing, for instance, has accepted or seems to acknowledge that there is a Taliban sort of near ambassador that is operating in Beijing and equally has a high commission inside Kabul that is essentially viewed as if it's a diplomatic mission as well. So there's sort of some areas in some countries that are kind of getting closer to that recognition. But in terms of the world at the moment, there is no international recognition yet for the Taliban.
Right. So are the Taliban seeing this as, you know, a bit of a breakthrough in those terms, that it is the world talking to them?
Well, the UN are very adamant that this is not about recognition. They've said that again and again in the build up to these particular talks. And if you speak to quite a few people here about it, they've said the whole point of these talks is to start the process that could lead in the direction of eventually getting recognition. But this is very much talks that could lead to more talks, that could lead to more talks, that could eventually at some stage down the line lead to some form of recognition. And I really feel that that is being kind of held over the Taliban as some form of carrot to encourage them to keep on coming to these talks, along with other things. As you mentioned, the kind of key discussion points that are happening here are going to be about the anti-narcotics and also about the private sector. There has been controversy around these particular talks. The Taliban, it's the first time they're going to be here meeting en masse with the international community. They were invited to talks here back in February, but didn't attend because at that point they would have had to attend the meeting with representatives from civil society. They have said that they don't want to be in the room with those representatives from civil society. And this time round, the UN has said that they accept that. That means that there will not be women in the room from Afghanistan representing Afghanistan's point of view and side. And that has been a real point of controversy for human rights groups. And we know that various members of civil society groups have actually decided not to attend some other meetings that will be happening on Tuesday afterwards because they are so angry about the fact that the UN have agreed to these terms.
Okay, well, let's go. Thank you very much, Carrie Davis. Let's get a bit more on that aspect of all this now with Fawzia Koofi, who's a politician and women's rights activist, first woman vice president of the Afghan Parliament, chair of its Women's Affairs and Human Rights Commission. Fawzia Koofi, what's your take on the UN basically going along with the idea there'll be no women at these talks?
Not only woman, no woman is invited in the table, but also the severe human rights violation of our century that's happening in Afghanistan is being ignored and being taken out of agenda just to listen to the Taliban and bring them. What is frightening, over the past 5 years, there has been concession after concessions, flexibility after flexibility, not only from the UN side, but from the international community. In their engagement, I must say, in their reckless engagement with Taliban, which has actually led to Taliban being more empowered and emboldened, and the people of Afghanistan being sidelined, especially the women. Taliban do not see any need to listen to international condition or international pressure or listen to the women and people of Afghanistan, because they think no matter what they do, no matter how repressive their measures are, the world is obliged to work with them. Now, what we don't understand is, what is it that the world is so obliged? Is it the regional conflict, geopolitical conflict? Is it the interest, the economic interests of different countries that actually make them to listen only to Taliban?
Well, I think the answer to that is pretty clear, isn't it? The Taliban won the war. You know, they're in power.
I don't think so. I don't think they won the war. I think the Taliban, Afghanistan was given to the Taliban. Remember, the Taliban fought for 20 years. And in 20 years, they were not able to control one district for more than 24 hours. But only after the deal was signed, and I was part of the negotiation with the hope that we will be able to bring a government that is accepted by all, including the Taliban, and including the women, and including the critical voices. But after they signed the deal with Americans, they were empowered morally so much that our troops were demoralized and they managed to get to Kabul. I don't think they managed to get to Kabul because they won the war. And this is a narrative that Taliban actually empower, which is not a true narrative. I was in those rooms.
Well, yes, but I mean, let's face it. The West spent billions of dollars. It lost a lot of lives trying to fight the Taliban. And it didn't succeed.
Well, yes, and that's why we thought fight and war is not the only solution. And that's why we went to negotiation. Not only the West invested blood and treasure, but us, also the people of Afghanistan, invested blood and treasure. So, but the way out of all of this was not the way the withdrawal happened. It was not the way to empower one side of the war and demoralize and marginalize the other side of the war. If there was a war and the war had a party, I think the government of Afghanistan, well, I was a political opposition, and you know that. But as a matter of principle, the government of Afghanistan should have been engaged from day one when these negotiations happened, which did not. So now that resulted to the collapse, total profound collapse of our government and failure from the international community as well as the Afghan politician. But we are in a new chapter. And again, the UN and international community is repeating the same mistakes. So our call was that the UN should actually respect the same independent assessment report produced by their special envoy, the UN Charter.
Understood.
And do not only listen to the Taliban, listen to all sides. And how you form a political process.
Thank you, Fawzia Koofi. We got your point. Thank you very much indeed. That was Fawzia Koofi there. Now, Glastonbury is the largest music festival in Europe. It's held in the English county of Somerset every year, and thousands of music lovers camp out, hoping to see their favourite artists. Headliners at this year's five-day festival have included Coldplay and Dua Lipa, but there's a new addition to the stage. Now, this is the Voice of Baceprot. They're the first Indonesian band to play, and it's made up of three women in hijabs. And they've been speaking with our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Hello, my name is Marcia. I'm the guitarist and vocalist.
My name is Siti. I'm a drummer.
I'm Rudy. I'm a bass player.
I mean, you're the first Indonesian band to play at Glastonbury. How does that feel?
Very excited.
Yeah, so proud. And also, this is a big responsibility because we are become the representation of Indonesia.
but a little nervous.
We are so proud to be here. I feel like I am falling, wish down,
swallowed by the crowd. What's it like to be an all-female metal band in a Muslim country? Have you faced a lot of obstacles?
First, yeah, because many people misunderstood about metal music. But now, after they knew that metal music is just medium for us to express ourselves, they give us full support.
What has the reaction been to your music in the UK and also at home? Have you had a positive reaction?
Oh, yeah. On 26th. Yeah. June.
Yeah.
We are performing in London.
So many people came to our show.
Yes.
And they are very supportive and excited about our show.
Yes.
And this is your first time in the UK. Do you like it?
Yeah.
I like it so much.
But it's cold.
Sorry about that. Hopefully the sun comes out soon. Good luck with your set.
Thank you so much.
The media owner Rupert Murdoch started with a paper in Australia, but first made real money in the UK when he was close to the Conservative leader then, Margaret Thatcher. And she backed him as he took on the print unions, and his papers backed her. With one exception, Labour leader Tony Blair, his newspapers have always backed Conservatives in the UK since then. Well, with voting for a new British Parliament due on Thursday, one of the big Murdoch papers in London, the Sunday Times, has repeated that Blair moment. It's supporting Labour. George Parker is the political editor of the Financial Times. Why has the Sunday Times backed Labour?
Rupert Murdoch, the owner of News Corporation, these titles, inevitably wants to back winners. You know, there's only a commercial advantage, to be honest, to be gained in endorsing a party which is about to be in government, not one which is about to spend a number of years in opposition.
And I mean, that's the case because, and it's, I don't think anyone could really disagree with this, he's managed to get regulatory changes in his favour from governments in Britain for decades, hasn't he?
Well, exactly. I mean, he'll want something in return. I mean, there's always an advanced level of courtship between Rupert Murdoch and whoever is vying for power in Britain. And most famously, of course, just before the 1997 election, Tony Blair travelled right across the world to address a load of News Corporation executives in an island just off the coast of Australia. And people thought this was a sort of a ludicrous example of kowtowing, but we saw the results of that, which was that the Murdoch papers, including the Sun newspaper, which was very influential at the time, came out and supported him.
Well, I did wonder about that contrast, because the leader of the British Labour Party now, Starmer, has not courted Murdoch in the same way. I mean, he's got this endorsement without really working for it, hasn't he?
Yeah, not. I mean, there have been back-channel communications for sure. That's been going on behind the scenes, but nothing like the kind of level of sycophancy, if you like, of Tony Blair going across to address this these executives. I think Starmer has taken the view, correctly in my view, that Murdoch's papers will support him if he looks like he's a winner. But it's an interesting ritual ahead of an election. And I think probably you may be about to ask me this question, does this actually matter very much anymore? I think less so than it used to.
Yeah, because the newspapers haven't got the circulations they used to have. Digital media is more important.
No, exactly. I mean, back in 1992, which was an election that surprisingly won by the Conservatives under John Major, the Sun came out and launched a real campaign of vilification against the Labour leader at the time, who was Neil Kinnock, famously ran a headline saying that we're the last person in Britain to switch off the lights with a picture of Neil Kinnock's head as a light bulb. And then afterwards, infamously or famously, the Sun claimed it was the Sun what won it in 1992. In those days, the print papers had huge circulations. They were very, very influential. They could destroy people's political careers. Of course, nowadays, print circulations are in a massive decline, but they are still influential, I would say, in two respects. One is, you know, an endorsement from a paper like the Sunday Times gives an indication of the breadth of appeal of a political party. The other thing I think is it shapes the way that newspapers cover politics. You know, if your paper is supportive of a party, if you're the Murdoch titles, it will imply that your news coverage will be slightly less hostile than otherwise would have been. And that is important, I think, for the political debate, because newspapers do still shape the broadcast and social media agenda to a certain extent.
And that was George Parker. He is the political editor of the Financial Times on Murdoch's latest endorsement. Now, the BBC has seen and heard evidence that Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank carried injured Palestinian men on the bonnet of a military jeep at least three times during an operation in Jenin earlier this month. It follows a video that emerged last week showing one of the men, Mujahid Abadi Balas, being driven on the front of the car, sparking international concern. Well, the BBC has now spoken to two more people who say the same thing happened to them. Lucy Williamson reports from Jenin.
On a winding village road outside Jenin, an Israeli military jeep drives past waiting Palestinian ambulances. Stretched out on its bonnet, a Palestinian man. One arm clinging to the vehicle, the other lying motionless across his body, with what appears to be a large bloodstain near the shoulder. The figure on the bonnet was 23-year-old Mujahid Abadi Balas, shot during an Israeli operation last weekend. More than a week on, Mujahid is lying in a hospital bed. The gunshot wounds to his leg and shoulder framed with external metal fixtures. Burns on his back from the hot metal of the military jeep.
They were beating me on the injury in my leg and shoulder. They were checking where my injuries were and beating me there.
He shows me another video in which a group of soldiers appear to pick him up and throw him onto the vehicle.
What was it like?
I was saying my final prayers. I was expecting to die.
Mujahid's story caused international outrage, but it's not the only one. In the hospital, we also met Samir Dabaya. Shot in the back during the same military raid. And, he says, carried to an army vehicle, stripped of his trousers and thrown onto the bonnet. A few brief seconds of footage from a nearby security camera appear to show him, half naked, on the same army jeep. Both men say they were shot around a house in the Jabriyat area of Jenin as Israeli forces came to arrest a wanted man. the walls there still marked by sniper fire.
To where the jeep came.
At the house, a third man, Hesham Islet, a large bandage on his leg, shows me the olive grove, where he says he too was shot and then forced onto the hot metal bonnet of the same military vehicle.
These tracks here, I guess, yeah.
I tried to put my hand on the jeep. I couldn't. It was burning hot. But they forced me, saying that I should get on it if I didn't want to die.
All three men were later released by Israeli forces. The army said Mujahid's case violated orders and procedures and would be investigated, and that the new allegations we put to them were under review. Jenin has been a target for Israeli raids since the 7th of October Hamas attacks. Since then, Israeli forces have killed more than 120 Palestinians there, civilians and fighters. But armed men still patrol Jenin camp, where the armed groups are based, and residents in the town say there's no sign of the battle subsiding.
What the Israeli army doesn't know is the resistance is an idea planted in the heart. It will not stop. If one Palestinian gets killed, five more will replace him.
During an Israeli operation this week, bombs buried deep in the roads hit troops as they drove in, killing one soldier and wounding 16 others. This battle began long before the Gaza war, but tactics here on both sides are shifting in its wake, and the behaviour of Israeli troops is under scrutiny here too. This is different territory to Gaza, but it's the same adversaries, the same war.
And that report from Lucy Williamson. Well, the UN says conditions for Palestinians in the northern Gaza Strip are now unbearable following a flare-up in fighting there. The Israeli military has been using warplanes, tanks and drones in the area for 3 days now. It's one of those places where Hamas seems to have shown a capacity to regroup in areas once considered cleared by the IDF. Louise Wateridge is a spokesperson for UNRWA, the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees, and she's currently in central Gaza. What does she know of what's happening in the north?
The last few days, there's been heavy bombing from the Israeli air forces and tanks in neighbourhoods east of Gaza City in the north of the Gaza Strip. So this sudden land incursion with heavy shelling in addition to the Israeli air forces bombardment has resulted in several injuries and casualties in the homes and in the streets. We see hundreds of people fleeing in the streets without their belongings. On social media, it's been flooded with videos of young children clearly very distressed, grabbing anything they can, trying to flee away from this danger and find some kind of safety. And unfortunately, this has just been a recurring image that we've seen throughout the last 8 months across the Gaza Strip, not only in the north, but of course now the south since the Rafah invasions happened. And these people are living a recurring nightmare. As I speak to you now from the middle area of the Gaza Strip, I can hear bombardments everywhere. I can hear them in the south. I can hear them coming from the north. This is constant and it just spreads fear for everyone around us.
Can you just tell us where people are living? Because, I mean, people did move south and then there were the campaigns in Rafah. So is the population mainly in the south? How come so many were living up north in this area that's affected?
At the beginning of the war, most of the population was forcibly displaced to the southern areas of the Gaza Strip. Some did stay. Of course, these evacuation orders, these forced displacements, they happen very quickly. Not everybody can move in the space of, you know, sometimes it's been a couple of hours, sometimes overnight. You have a lot of elderly people, families with young children. One of my colleagues, he's really struggled to move his elderly parents. His father has dementia and wakes up in a different place, continuously confused as to why he's there and what's going on. So for so many reasons, a lot of people can't actually flee. And that's the reason they are still in the north. They're doing everything they can to survive. The north is, it's apocalyptic. There's no other way to describe it. Going through Gaza City, everywhere you look, the buildings are not buildings anymore. They are shells. You can see life that used to be there. And the sad reality is people now are faced with the decision of living back in these buildings, which are rubble and basically skeletons. You know, you can see where a stairwell used to be or a wall used to be. They're putting up sheets of plastic or carpet or anything to protect them from the sun now that we've entered the summer months. Or they're living in and among piles of trash and piles of rubbish. There are makeshift shelters where people have set up along the coastline. There's no space. We drove through Khan Yunis the other day. This is an area in the south that's also been bombed out. And again, people are living in these skeleton building structures. There's no water. There's nowhere to go to the bathroom. It's very, very basic, and there's very limited supplies available to the population.
What is the status of your organization now, UNRWA? Because the Israelis have made clear their distrust of UNRWA. Are you operating freely? How does it affect what you're doing?
UNRWA is doing everything it can, like all UN agencies, all NGOs on the ground here. But as you say, yes, it is severely restricted access. We struggle to receive aid. We struggle to get permission to deliver the aid. There's a lot of checkpoints throughout the Gaza Strip where we have to coordinate with Israeli authorities continuously, not only for our safety, but for the security of the food and everything that we're delivering. And it's a struggle. Humanitarians are here. They are wanting to work. We have doctors, we have nurses, we have people in our clinics. But if we don't have the medicine to give the patients, there's very limited we can do. With these access restrictions from the Israeli authorities, it is incredibly difficult, if not nearly impossible, for us to deliver humanitarian response.
And that was the UN's Louise Waterridge there in central Gaza. We did ask the Israeli government for a response to what she's saying, but nobody got back to us. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, though, did say today that Israel's not stopping until it has achieved its war goals, sometimes fighting above ground and sometimes underground. You're listening to NewsHour. 4 years ago today, India banned TikTok. It's one of the few countries to have actually taken action against social media, and it's TikTok, owned by the Chinese company ByteDance, over data security concerns, the reason that India did it. Others, including the US, are thinking about it, but how does it work out? Well, Davina Gupta has been looking at what effect the ban has had in India. I am
the best at this. In early 2020, India was TikTok's largest foreign market with 200 million users. It had quickly become a hit with people like Sumit Jain in the western Indian state of Maharashtra, who grew a following of 4 million.
I own a clothes shop. My friends told me we can share videos on TikTok to show our talent.
Mithali Nikore, founder and chief economist at Nikore Associates, a youth-led think tank in New Delhi, says TikTok's combination of video and music, as well as its ease of use, helped its rapid growth in India.
The algorithms on TikTok also just make things much easier to find, and they don't necessarily favor only the established users, but also new users. And the ability to add songs, etc., in a country like India, that makes a lot of difference, because then you can have, you know, Bollywood-related content which people can prepare on their own.
But growing tensions between India and China led Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government to raise concerns about Chinese-owned apps that held large amounts of data about their users, like TikTok. Then on June 29th, 2020...
As tensions along the border mount, the Indian government has cracked down on Chinese apps.
The Indian government has decided to ban 59 Chinese apps, including the very popular TikTok.
If you've not been living under a rock by now, you know that the government of India has announced the ban of 59 Chinese applications in the country.
But economist Nikore says once TikTok was gone, users quickly found other platforms.
There are some homegrown platforms like ShareChat. ShareChat has almost 80 million users. It does have a good market share. YouTube Shorts got a huge boost in popularity because YouTube is an easy-to-use application. It's international and pretty much have the same features.
Nikore says it's difficult to quantify the economic impact of banning TikTok and the other 58 Chinese-owned apps. But she doesn't think India-based apps have been the biggest winners from the change.
When TikTok was present, It's not as though those same users were not present on Instagram or YouTube. You know, they were still there. They were just there on different multiple platforms. I would say that the space that a lot of these platforms used to hold was taken by a lot of American platforms.
Nikore says it's not impossible that TikTok and other apps could return to India if they address the government's concerns. But 4 years after the ban, the question is whether the users would return to them.
And whether others will follow India's example. That was Davina Gupta reporting on the ban on TikTok in India and what difference it's made. You're listening to NewsHour on the World Service of the BBC. President Biden has pardoned thousands of US veterans convicted under a military law that banned gay sex. These are historic cases. There was an outright ban, this is the history of it, an outright ban up to 1993. Then Clinton introduced Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then in 2011, that gave way because President Obama repealed that, getting us to the current situation whereby service members can reveal they're gay without fear of investigation or discharge. Well, Julian Warwicker has been speaking to two former service women who've now been pardoned by this Biden move, Carla Lehman and Mona Maguire. And their cases go back to 1988, the time of the total ban. They were in a same-sex relationship while serving abroad in Germany, and were arrested by members of the US Army's Criminal Investigation Division, the CID. Mona Maguire first tells us the story of the arrest.
We early in the morning, between maybe the hours of 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., it was in May, and there was just loud pounding and noise at my barrack door. And we let the person pounding in, who was a CID detective or investigator, and he was arresting me. I didn't know exactly what I was being arrested for, but I was being arrested. I was handcuffed. All of my bedding was put in plastic bags, and I was then escorted out of my barrack room, which there's like a hallway or a corridor. And as I'm walking out, I see the other three individuals walking out in the same situation. They each had a unique CID investigator with them, plastic bags with bedding, clothing of sort. And then we were all put into separate individual cars, taken down to the headquarters of the CID. And there we were fingerprinted, mugshot, and interrogated for 7 to 8 hours. It was an aggressive interrogation. They were nasty. They were just saying awful, terrible things. After all of those hours being beaten down, we eventually admitted to being in same-sex relationships, and that started the end of our career as we knew it in the Army.
Carla, what are your memories of that time?
They're actually very similar to Mona's memories. I was afraid. Mona didn't know why we were being arrested. I mean, I guess deep down inside, I kind of had a feeling because we knew we lived in fear of being discovered. It was really scary. We were in another country. We were young. And I remember, too, asking multiple times to use the bathroom, and they wouldn't even offer us that dignity. They drove us 2 hours away without even offering that to happen.
You made a remark a moment ago about living in fear during that period and having that sort of worry in your mind that something like this could happen.
We knew that homosexuals were not welcome in the military, but we also were beginning a budding relationship. And so it was a lot about the people that we trusted and being careful about the places that we went. We just knew that we did not want to be discovered because we didn't want to lose our military careers.
Well, when you're in uniform, you're not supposed to show, you know, a lot of emotion or anything. We were on base. We never like held hands or showed any, you know, emotion to each other. I mean, you just didn't do that. You know, we would go off on our weekends because we all had a life. We had private weekends and that. There were other American soldiers there, and maybe some of the American soldiers knew us. Maybe they took down names. We're not sure.
Let's talk about the immediate aftermath of that night when you were both taken in for this interrogation. Carla, what was the first sort of immediate consequence of that?
eventually we were brought back to our bases. Our security clearances were removed. We were not allowed to work our regular duty. We weren't allowed to sign out firearms any longer. Apparently we couldn't be trusted. And we were relegated to answering phones, washing cars, and painting things. That's the only things we were allowed to do.
But I was reduced to cleaning latrines. Those yeah. are the bathrooms, and it was the male latrines. After our interrogation and our admitting, it was embarrassing because some people had seen or heard the noise, the disruption. So now we're back on base, and people are, I feel like, eyes are on us like, ooh, look at them. What, you know, what's going on? But being reduced to cleaning latrines and then having male soldiers prance around naked was humiliating and embarrassing of itself.
I'm struck by how young you both were at the time. You were, what, 19 years old. You are forced out of the military. What do you say to family? You both chuckle at that, but I don't suppose it was funny at the time.
No. So for me, I had one family member that I was talking to by phone, a trusted aunt, and she knew the truth of what was happening. But I wasn't gay when I went in. I left a boyfriend behind. I didn't know I was gay. And so for me, not only was I dealing with this criminal allegation against me and a possible federal conviction for it, but I also was being outed. And it was uncomfortable and humiliating. And I did not tell my mother and my grandfather, who was a military vet from World War II. I did not tell them the truth when I returned.
And Mona, for you?
In Germany, you didn't have a lot of opportunity to talk with your family. So I had only spoken with my family maybe once or twice. So when I just all of a sudden showed up on the front door, you know, knocking, and my mom comes to the door, she's like, well, hello, why are you here? You're supposed to be in Germany. What's going on? So it was humiliating. It was embarrassing having to now, you know, explain to not only my family, but I grew up in a small town. It was just horrible. It was a bad time in my life.
We're talking about the late 1980s here. Let me bring it up to the present day and the decision taken by the president to correct what he calls a great injustice by pardoning thousands of people, dating back to the kinds of era that we've been discussing. Mona, what does that mean to you? What difference will it make?
Well, in our case, we admitted guilt. So I do not think that we fall under the pardon, because we did not serve prison time. But it is a step forward. It's a small step forward. It's bringing attention. People are opening up. They're respecting us more. They're caring about our lives more. So in that respect, in that regard, it's a positive.
A final word on a sort of personal note. People listening will have heard the conversation and will probably wonder. You're no longer together, but you're clearly still very, very good friends and have kept in touch.
Oh, absolutely. I consider Carla one of my dearest friends. Here in Milwaukee, she's the whole reason I'm in the Wisconsin-Milwaukee area.
You know, over the years, you live separate lives and you try and stay in touch. And this process has created an environment for us to stay more in touch and to go through this part together. You know, to have somebody to walk this journey with that understands it is special.
And that was Carla Lehmann, and before her, Mona McGuire, both pardoned. And they bring us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. So thanks very much for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.